This time, I'd like to welcome our speaker, and this evening we have Eric, who is from the Mercer Street Group in Princeton, New Jersey.
Evening, everybody. My name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Eric.
I'd like to thank Tim and Braylon for taking a ride with me, bringing me out here tonight. It's very nice. There's another one. This guy, Sean, here, it was a surprise. You know, I come all the way out here. I guess we're about an hour and a half away. And, yeah, I don't think I'm going to know anybody. And here I am, standing here, and this guy walks in, the guy with a beard and a red sweatshirt. And I sponsored Sean for about 30 seconds a long time ago. And, you know, my ego would have me believe he cannot get along without me. But the truth is Sean's doing just fine. He was just telling me about his life, and he's, you know, he's graduating from graduate school, got a fantastic girlfriend, great job. Everything's going along just fine without me. And that's a beautiful thing. So I'll tell you that if you do, you know, you work this program, you're going to be all right. You don't need me. I don't need me. I am my problem. I have been my problem all of my life. I got sober March 19th, 20th, or 21st. It's a little foggy. 1986. I suppose if I could figure out what day it was, I could probably go backwards, just take the weeks back and figure out exactly which date it was, but it's not that important to me. I really don't care too much about time. I know that I've been without a drink for a long time, but I could tell you that there has been periods in my life that you would not want what I have, even with double-digit time away from a drink. I know that happens. Alcoholism is a brutal disease. It has a way of working. Hey, man, how's it going? Has its way of working in there and working you over. You know, it can take over at different times. We were kidding. I said, I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth tonight. And Tim said, well, if it's not good, we'll be waiting in the car for you. So I said, all right, no problem. I said, do me a favor. When you go out there, tell my disease, you know, the disease you hear, it's outside doing push-ups. Tell it I'll be out when I'm done. And I kind of make fun of that because the truth is that I don't believe that my disease is going to give me an hour break to go into a meeting. I really don't. I don't think it's going to say, you go in there, get sober, I'll be out here waiting for you. I think my disease says, you know what, I'm coming in with you, and I'm going to make sure that you judge every person in there and that you don't hear a single thing of hope because I don't want you to recover. And that's what I believe. I don't think my disease is ever going to give me a minute break. I really don't. So, you know, that kind of blows up a lot of things that we hear in the rooms. We hear a lot of different things like, you know, don't drink, go to meetings, which is a nice suggestion. It's helpful, but it's not the solution. Change people, places, and things. You can do that all that you want, but, you know, when we hit that strange mental blank spot that they talk about in the book, I don't care who you're with or where you are and what you're doing. If that comes on, you don't stand a chance. Even with all these years sober, Timmy and I were talking the other day. He drives me around a lot, not for any other reason except that he likes to drive me around. So we're sitting outside my house and we're having this conversation, and we talk about that part in We Agnostics where it says, you know, we're faced with, you know, doomed to an alcoholic death or having to live our life based on spiritual principles. And at no point in time does that change for us. Every single day I'm faced with that. I can either live my life based on spiritual principles, or I can choose not to live my life on self-will and be doomed to an alcoholic death. But that's not a drinking death necessarily, which is kind of a scary thought, you know, because alcoholism doesn't necessarily equate to alcohol, you know. And that was my big misunderstanding when I came into these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in here as an alcoholic, meaning that I have an alcohol problem. And I really thought if I just didn't drink and I go to meetings, then my problem was going to be solved and that I was going to be just fine, you know. And I did that for a long time. I went to meetings. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't doing any of this stuff. Those things were on the wall, but they weren't in my life. Then eventually they made it into my head, but they didn't make it to my heart. And it wasn't until they got in my heart that they were actually being practiced in my life, and my life changed. But for all those years that I just had it up here or was on the wall, I was suffering from alcoholism, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just couldn't understand. It didn't make any sense. I didn't understand this phenomenon of craving. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't understand this allergy. I didn't understand this thing, once it starts, I can't stop, and, you know, da-da-da-da-da, all that. I didn't understand any of that. It just didn't make any sense. I heard, don't drink, go to meetings. If you didn't drink today, you're a winner. And I couldn't understand why I still wanted to put a bullet in your head and in mine. You know, I couldn't understand why I was getting kicked out of every place that I lived and I was losing every single job that I had. I couldn't understand why nobody wanted to be my friend. I couldn't understand why I would wake up in the morning and the first thing I'd see the ceiling. And all I wanted to do was pull the covers over my head and I would start cursing God, thinking, because I cannot face another day like this because it's so excruciatingly painful to get out of bed, to deal with all those resentments, to deal with all that worry, to deal with all that fear and go out there and have to somehow build up the courage to work my way through it. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it, but that was my life every single day. Bill Wilson talks about it. He says the mind and the body are marvelous things. They have this marvelous mechanisms. They have this amazing ability to endure this kind of stuff. And I was able to endure that not drinking, going to meetings for a long time. And it's absolutely a miracle that I didn't take a drink. And it had nothing to do with me. It was truly the grace of God, even though I was not approaching God. God somehow worked his way in there, worked his way into my life, and kept me away from a drink. I don't know how it happened. I just know that it did. However, God was a gentleman, and he said, if you want to go out and destroy your life by being dishonest, selfish, self-centered, lie to everybody, cheat, steal, do all those things, you are more than welcome. I will let you endure all that pain you want. And when you're done, then you can turn and come back to me. And he let me do that. And I drove my life into the ground, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely mangled it. I was a liar. I was a cheater, a thief. I'll tell you a little bit what it was like. When I was getting sober in Princeton, I had a couple years sober. I started sleeping with a guy who 12-stepped me, not him, his girlfriend. I better clear that up. Just saying, I think this is on tape, right? Let me be clear. No, either way, it doesn't make a difference. I was sleeping with his girlfriend, this guy 12-stepping. That's the kind of guy I am. Thank you for helping save my life. Now I'm going to sleep with the girlfriend. Right? Hey, look, I'm a winner today. I didn't drink, right? But that was the mentality that I had, okay? And then what I was doing was I had this Monday night meeting at Unitarian Church. We passed the basket, and after the meeting was done, I was like, thank you very much. Right in my pocket, and the money went. Because that's how I thought it was. The basket is for me. It's okay. I mean, I'm the one who does all this. Shouldn't I benefit from this deal? And that's what I thought. And then I got busted sleeping with that girl. And then I got caught stealing that money. And I couldn't take it. So the first thing that I did was I go down to the local travel agency. I buy a ticket for California and I take off that night. Took off for California that very night. Because I couldn't face it. Because I couldn't say, hey man, I'm just a pig. And I was wrong. I need help. I don't know how not to do this stuff. I shouldn't have taken the money. I thought it was mine. I still thought it was mine. You know what I mean? I go to California. When I'm out in California, I go into meetings out there and I put my hand in the air and say, my name's Eric. I'm new. People come up. They welcome you. I want to take you to the diner. I don't have any place to stay. Hey, man, you can crash on my couch. And guess what I do? I crash on their couch. And when they would get up and go to work, I would go through their house and take what I wanted and leave. Go on to another meeting. Because that's what I did. Not drinking, going to meetings. And I thought that I was a winner today because I didn't drink. That's not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mugged people, stole from people, robbed an electronic appliance store from the people who were stealing from the electronic appliance store. I knew it was an easy target. I pulled up there with my buddy Rich. We pulled up and I said, dude, what the? This, they beat us to it. The window's broken. They're unloading it. So what did we do? We waited for him. He said, we'll go someplace else. I said, no, you never go to jail from stealing from the thief. So we waited for him to load it up, and we stole their truck and all the stuff in it. That's how we did it. Let them, if there's an alarm, let them go down, right? My dad didn't raise a fool. That's the truth. It's crazy. Why am I telling you this? Because I don't think that's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's a lot of the stuff that happens in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor who told me, he says, if you quit drinking, if you're a horse thief, you were a drunken horse thief, you'll be a better horse thief now because you're not drinking anymore. It's what I heard. And I did that for a number of years sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My biggest problem in terms of relationships was that I was never loyal. I was never honest in a relationship. Never ever could be honest in a relationship. I could never stay loyal or faithful in a relationship. Not because I was a stud and I just had so many opportunities thrown at me. It was because I felt so insecure that I'd have to go out seeking it to make myself feel better. Because I believed that she was going to cheat on me and leave me, so I have to strike first. I'm going to have to abuse you in a relationship. I need you to feel less than and inadequate only for me to feel okay. I need you to throw out a parade for me every single day for me to feel okay. And if you don't do that, I'm going to feel less than and inadequate and I'm going to punish you. Because it's your responsibility to make me feel okay. And I would always wonder why every girl left me. every time. And I am one of those ridiculous fools. I'm really grateful when we pulled in. I saw that sign outside. It said the wise and the foolish are welcome. I said, I knew I was in the right place. You know, the foolish is here. I'm one of those guys that when they leave and I know that it's my fault, I'm asking God, like, God, why are you doing this to me? Like, why do you do this? And the tears are flowing and I turn into this big mess and all this stuff. God didn't do it to me. God just said, if that's the way you want to live, you can go right ahead and do that. This is what you're going to get, you know? This is what you're going to get. When you lie, cheat, and steal, and abuse, they leave. They're not going to stay around. Now, I did that for a number of years. I did all of this not drinking. And I believed that that was alcoholism. I believed that was the alcoholic death that I was dying. I was suffering from alcoholism, sitting in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Had nothing to do with alcohol. I'll tell you what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in an alcoholic household. My father's an alcoholic. Both of my older brothers are drug addicts, alcoholics, compulsive gamblers, liars, cheaters, thieves. Same thing I am. The whole deal. I had my very first drink. Let me put it this way. I don't exactly remember when I had my very first drink, but I can tell you when I needed my very first drink, probably about 30 seconds out of the womb. You know, I was born with a resentment. I was born filled with fear. I was born feeling less than inadequate. My mom loved me to death, but I was afraid she was going to leave me. I never believed that she really loved me. You know, my father, he was a very, very tough guy. He was in the Navy. He was in the Marines and, you know, he loves me very, very much, but he had a very odd way of showing it. So that was really awkward. I could never really figure out exactly where I fit in there. He was a big drinker. He loved Manhattans. Every single day he would come home from work and he'd make a big picture of Manhattans. And on the weekends there was always a pitcher of Manhattan sitting in the refrigerator. And that's what I got started on, was sipping on Manhattans. Sunday afternoon, my mom would be sitting on one end of the couch. My father would be sitting on the other end of the couch. And, you know, he's one of those guys that when he's starting to drink, like the shoes come off and I would watch him. I'm an actor. So I study behavior and human behavior. So I'm watching him and the sock, he would get his finger in there and he would slowly push the sock down his leg and it would hang off the end of his foot. And he's sitting there sipping his cocktail. Then the sock would come off and then the other leg would go up and then the other sock would come up. And this is the way it was. Every single Sunday, it was the same routine. And I knew when the socks were coming off that he was getting a really good buzz, you know? And then my mom, she was sitting there with a Winston with an ash this long hanging off of her cigarette. And she was knitting or reading her magazine. The golf was on and I'm sitting in between them. I'm bouncing back and forth, sipping off the Manhattans. And after a while, my mom would say, "You've had enough. No more." I said, "Okay, no problem." Go over to Dad. "Nope." Your mother said, "No more. That's it." But I knew that if I waited a half hour, 40 minutes, that they would forget. So I'd wait and I could go back and I'd say, "Can I get another sip?" My mom would say, "Okay, just a small one. No problem." Then bounce back over to Dad, give him another small sip. And, you know, and that's the way I did it. And then I caught on. I said, "What am I going to these guys? They're like the middlemen. Let's go to the source. The pitcher is in the refrigerator." Okay, so the way the refrigerator, the kitchen's set up, I can open up the refrigerator, step into the refrigerator. The door is blocking me. I can pull the pitcher out, drink right out of that, put it back in, close the door, and go back. And the beautiful thing is I've been sipping off the drink, so I don't have to worry about them saying, "You smell like alcohol. You gave it to me," you know? So I was good. But here's what's crazy about that, is that I never felt the effects of the alcohol other than when it was going down the throat. I felt the burn, but I didn't get a buzz from that. And I don't know why. It never made any sense and it still doesn't make much sense to me. I was young, I was small, and you would think that I would have felt the buzz. I didn't get it. I felt the effects from alcohol was when I was just turning 12. I was over at my buddy Mike's house. His mother was fresh, newly divorced, and she got the beach house, she got some money, and she bought herself a, you know, convertible Porsche, and she had her girlfriend and rounded her up, and she's going down to the beach on a manhunt that weekend. And she left me home with Mike and the older sister who was 16 years old. I really don't know what she's thinking about, why she did that, but she did do that. And she took off, and I'm staying there for the weekend, and the exhaust fumes haven't even gotten out of the garage yet. And I looked at Mike, and I said, "Let's make some cocktails." I'm barely 12 years old. And he's like, "What are you talking about? What are you?" He looked at me like I had six heads on my shoulder. And he's like, "Do you mean alcohol?" I said, "Yeah, alcohol, man, because I'm familiar with it. It's the norm at home. There's alcohol, right? Here, let's do this, man." So he wasn't too keen on it. And he said, "Well, let's just go slow. What do you want? What do you want to make?" I said, "Look, let's make screwdrivers, because I know how to make a screwdriver, right? Come on." I mean, I thought I was a big shot, but, you know, two things, you know, the orange juice, the vodka. So we pull out these big glasses like this. and fill it, you know, 90% of it is orange juice, 10% vodka. And we put it down, and I don't feel anything. I don't feel the burn. There's no effects. I'm like, maybe we did it wrong. Let's do another. And then a little bit more vodka, a little bit more vodka. And then before you know it, we're back to the 90-10, but now it's 90% vodka, 10% orange juice, right? Now I'm starting to feel the burn. And now I'm starting to feel the effects of alcohol. And I got to tell you, what happened was absolutely phenomenal. It really was. And no kidding aside, it was my very first spiritual experience. It literally changed my life. I felt something that I had never, ever felt before. I didn't know that it was possible. It was some of the stuff that you would read about in books, but it was nothing that I ever thought was possible for me. When that alcohol kicked in, I went from feeling less than an inadequate, stupid, unworthy, ugly, you name it. I mean, that, it was gone like that. I went to being tall. I am tall, but you know, I went to being tall at that moment. I went to being attractive, smart. Most important, I felt hope for the first time in my life. I felt like I belonged. I felt like I fit in. I just, there, that hole in my heart was filled. It was truly filled. Something had changed. It was a psychic change. I had this confidence that I had never had before. I told Mike, I said, let's get the phone because I'm going to call so-and-so and I'm going to tell her how I'm feeling about her. Yeah. And I said, you know, what's his face? I am going to kick the ever-loving, you know, and all of this stuff. And all this happened very, very quickly. And then what happens when you have too much to drink? You start seeing twos and threes and fours of everything. Everything started to spin around. But just before that, I forgot, I should add this because that it'll make sense. So I said to Mike, I said, you know, when I came in on the garage, in the garage on the shelf, I noticed that there were all these six packs of warm, of Michelob up there. I said, let's have some beers too. He said, no. My mom, she, you know, she'll notice. I said, not if you take the ones from the back, you know, she's not going to notice that. So he agreed. So I had two or three of those. And this was all in like a 30-minute, 45-minute period. I pounded down three, four Michelobes, all this orange juice, all this vodka. You know, spiritual experience, everything's spinning. Before you know it, I am projectile vomiting all over the place. It's absolutely horrific. I black out. I pass out. I come to. It's like pancake batter with carrots in it, all smashed up on my face. I'm sorry, but you know, it's not his program. You know, and it was absolutely revolting. But you know what? It was totally fine by me. My parents found out about it. I'm at home now. I got to go deal with my dad. My dad was, he's in Marine Corps. He's still a Marine to the end of the day, you know, all this garbage. And I got to go to work with him. And his idea of work, it's got to be painful and it's got to stink. Because if it's fun and you're laughing, you're not working. And I got to deal with that too. You know, so my eyes are popping out of my head like they're on springs. I feel like I got an axe split right down the center of my head. My body aches. My mouth is dry. It's absolutely horrible. This hangover is the worst thing in the world. And I'm swearing I will never, ever, ever drink again. And I'm starting to pray for the first time in my life, asking God, please, please just remove this. Please remove this pain. I swear, God, I promise you, I will never, ever, ever do this again. And then my father came out to the truck and he brought a glass of orange juice. And I smelled that. And I'm like, it was my first experience with knowing that God was a punishing God. God said, you got to get through this. But I was able to get through that. I didn't drink that orange juice. He took it away. Eventually, I was able to get half of a chocolate donut down and a little bit of water. And that sugar helped, and I rehydrated myself. And then the aches and pains started to go away, and the head started to clear up. And then I started to review the events of that night. And one of the things that I realized is that you should never, ever, ever, this is just a recommendation, you go back out, don't ever mix warm Michelob with orange juice and vodka. It never works out. And I knew that that was an amateur mistake. That's why I got sick. That's why I passed out and blacked out. That's why I get caught. That's why if I didn't do that, none of this would have ever happened. I knew at that moment, if I don't do that again, I can drink successfully. So I went from feeling less than inadequate, having my first drink, feeling the experience of it, boom, seeing God, new person, taking on the world, vomiting, pass out, blackout, massive hangover, swearing off, asking God for, you know, for all this help. I start to feel better and I realize that I've made an amateur mistake and that I can drink again. All of this in like 24, 36 hour period of time. Complete 360, man. You know, from the very first time, I went to rationalizing my drinking. Sometimes it takes years for that to happen, I hear. But for me, it was just instantaneous. I mean, I was obsessed with alcohol from the day that I was born. I didn't even tell you about the beer can collection. I used to spend my weekends, even before all this happened, walk up and down these country roads picking up beer cans and beer bottles. I'd come back and stack them up in the basement. My parents were always like, well, yeah, at least he's got a hobby, you know? And it's a little peculiar, you know? He likes snakes. We're not going to let those in the house, but let him bring the beer cans in. You know, this was serious. I had thousands of beer cans and beer bottles stacked up down the basement. I would go to the Circle Liquors, the grocery store shop right in Pennington on the circle there, go in there. My mom would go grocery shopping. I would hang out in a liquor store and talk to the guys in there. I'm looking at the different beer cans and different beer bottles. They thought it was odd. You know, it felt normal to me. Then I would go out and I'd go into the dumpster on the side of the building and pull beer cans out. And there's always guys Friday afternoon, they had cashed their check and they're over there getting drunk and passing out in the car. And I'm like, hey guys, you know, I'm just picking up the beer can. It just seemed normal. I was just attracted to it, man. I was just the way that it was. I would be remiss if I told you that I did dabble in some other things. I absolutely positively did do those things. But I got to tell you, when I came in here and I really threw myself into 12 Steps of Alcoholics, for me, all those other things just went away. They just went away. I was not a drug addict. I just wasn't. I did mountains of them. I don't care, man. You got cocaine? Absolutely. Let's do it. Drug of choice, whatever you got. My favorite is whatever is free, you know? And that's the truth. It didn't matter. I would do it all. But none of those things ever did for me what alcohol did for me. I could snort a line of cocaine, and I swear to God, I'll still be sitting there feeling really crappy about myself. I can smoke weed, and I'll still feel less than inadequate. You give me drink, man, I got to tell you, there's a new man in town. There is a new man in town every single time, you know? It's wild, absolutely wild. So you would think that alcohol, from all of that, you hear that, you would think that alcohol is the problem, you know, but it's just not, unfortunately. And, you know, I don't know if anybody's new in here, and if you're still thinking that alcohol is your problem, you probably don't understand alcoholism. Alcoholism really has nothing to do with alcohol. Alcohol was the solution. Alcohol kept me alive long enough to make it into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't hate alcohol. I still love alcohol. Absolutely love it. I mean, I hold it. It's very fond. I mean, I have a very fond place in my heart for it. It did amazing things. Nothing ever did that for me. But I've also been restored to sanity today. You know, I've been completely restored to sanity, you know, in the sense that I just don't have a desire to drink. And I know what happens to me when I do drink. I don't have that obsession of the mind that's telling me this time it'll be different. Drink it out of a paper cup. Drink it out of a plastic cup. Shoot, become a vegan, then you can drink. You know, whatever it is, you know. There's all sorts of crazy things. I mean, you know, I just know there's absolutely no interest in it anymore, and I just know that I cannot drink successfully. I just can't do it. Once I put it in there, that phenomenon of craving kicks in. You know, when I read about that in the big book, this phenomenon, I didn't understand. I said, what's a phenomenon? It's unexplainable. I said, come on, seriously, explain it. They're like, no, literally, it is unexplainable. Like, you know, you guys, come on. It's unexplained. It's a phenomenon. They don't know why that this thing happens to us. I think science has come up with some different types of ideas how this happens to us once we put it in us, you know, that we trigger this thing, that we start craving more of it, and we're drinking beyond our, you know, whether we want to choose to drink or not, and so on and so on. I just know that that's my reality, that when I put alcohol in my body, I don't have the power of choice anymore. And the truth is that even before that, I don't have the power of choice, that I have to have something greater than me standing in between me and that drink. I need to be restored to sanity. You know, and the only way that was able to happen for me was through doing this. So when I came in and I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol, I didn't know what the heck I was talking about. I was saying, I got a drinking problem. I probably shouldn't drink it anymore. I didn't understand that I was powerless over alcohol, whether it was in my body or it wasn't. I didn't understand that I had this mind that was going to lie to me and tell me that this time it's going to be different, that it's okay. You know, just change people, places, and things. It'll be all right. You know, seriously, those are the things that I would hear, and those are the things that I would believe. And then my life was unmanageable. I believe that my life was unmanageable because of alcohol. Put the alcohol down, my life will suddenly become manageable by me again. No, my life's just unmanageable, period. You know, a lot of the things that I did, you know, I talk to people who say, tell me what it was like. What did alcohol do to you? And I have people say, well, you know, I got a DUI, you know, and I punched my wife and I lost my job. I say, no, that's not what alcohol did to you. That's what you did. That's what you did. Nothing to do with what alcohol did to you. What did alcohol do to you? Alcohol had that amazing ability to change my perception of life. absolutely amazing ability, so that I had this perception that second half of my first step, of the first step, that my life was now manageable, that it wasn't so bad, and now I'm going to be able to pull it off. That's what alcohol did for me. You know, that's the reality. Get me sober? Not anymore, man. Sitting in rooms, Alcoholics Anonymous, not drinking, going to meetings, and my life becomes excruciatingly painful. Excruciatingly painful. I had made that trip out to California the first time. I lived in California a number of times, but that first time was just a wild deal. I got myself into some trouble there that I needed to get away from. Fast forward 15 years later, I'm back in California, and I see one of the women that gave me a place to stay. It was not a relationship like that. She just let me stay on her couch, and I robbed her, and I walked up to her, and I said, "Hey, I don't know if you remember me, da-da-da-da-da." And she said, "I don't. You're not that impressive." And I was like, "What? Okay." And I said, "I stole all this stuff from you." She said, "Well, okay, I don't really remember that either." I said, "Well, I need to make amends to you, and I'd like to give you some money for all of those things. So if we can figure out what you think it would be, you know, the value of them, and so on and so on." And she said, "Look, man, just stay sober and keep putting money in a basket. And if you got extra money, throw it in a basket. You know, if I can't remember it, I obviously didn't need it. It wasn't that important. I'm just glad that you did that." I don't know why I just suddenly, you'll see, I'm going to bounce around a lot, but I ended up there. I was in California. I came back, and I was literally at a place where I was going to kill myself. And I was driving down 95 in Pennington, and it was coming up on Route 1. I was going to launch my car off that overpass down onto Route 1. Seemed like a good way to go. If I could get it up to 100, maybe I can get through that railing, get down there. And I really wasn't concerned about anybody that I was going to hit. If I hit somebody, whatever. I mean, it's just casually the way it goes. You know, because this is the way I thought. And I'm on the pedal. Carburetor opens up, four barrel. You hear that, you know, it's cooking. And I'm gripping that wheel, and I'm ready to go. And this thought goes through my head: why don't you go to the Wednesday night men's meeting and see if there's anything to these 12 steps? I have no idea where that came from, man. I have no idea. Instead of turning right, I just kept going straight. Instead of keeping that pedal down to the ground, my foot kind of came off the pedal. And I mean, it wasn't at that moment. I didn't feel any better. I just said, "All right, fine. I'm just going to go to this meeting tonight and see what's up with that." And I went in there, and when, you know, they used to bring in Carrier Clinic, Princeton House, some other rehab. And I mean, there was four or five literature tables a mile long, hundreds of different types of literature. I'm glad that that's not there anymore. I think there's way too much literature in AA. I'm sorry. I'm pretty opinionated about that stuff, but I think there's way too much literature in AA. It gets very, very confusing. But I walk in there, and I picked up the book, New Pair of Glasses. And I open it up right to the center of the book, and Chuck C's getting his phone call from a doctor, and the doctor's asking him a question at 10 o'clock at night. Chuck's pissed that he called at 10 o'clock at night rather than calling at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I can relate to this. I'm like, what is going on here? And he's pissed off. And doctor says, "Chuck, tell me what love is." Chuck said, "It's the same at 10 in the morning as it's 10 at night. Why are you calling me?" He said, "Chuck, I just need you to tell me what the definition of love is." Chuck says, "Love is an action. You do something for someone expecting nothing in return, for free and for fun, no price tags associated, nothing." And I was floored. And it was at that moment that I had my second spiritual awakening. I was blown away. It had a different effect on me, but it was at that moment that I realized that I had been a selfish, self-centered bugger, that I had never done anything for free and for fun. I always expected something from somebody. My idea of commitment was to take all that you could give, and then after that, I'm out of here. You know, that's just the way that it was, you know, and that's kind of scary. But I realized that at that moment that I played a major role in a lot of these things in my life. I didn't know how, but I knew that I played a major role in these things. So I bought that book, and I went home and I read that book, and I ended up reading that entire book that night. And I woke up the next day and I read the entire book again. And I probably read that thing 10, 12 times that following week, just over and over and over again. And every time I turned the page, everything I read became more and more profound. I just couldn't believe what I was reading. I couldn't believe that I had been missing this all of my life. I really felt like I had found the secret, the answer to this deal. This guy was telling me that if I do this stuff, I'm going to feel clean inside, that I can try to fill that hole with women, money, alcohol, and it will never be filled, that it is a God-shaped hole. And that was just mind-blowing to me. And he gave me hope in there, telling me that there was hope, that if I open up to God, that God would do these things. If I open up to God, that God was going to come into my life and he was going to change my life. I was totally blown away. But he mentioned the big book, and I said, I need to get this big book. I knew that I had one. As a matter of fact, I knew that I had my brother's old one before he went back out. And right inside, when I opened it up, it's inscribed to my father, who's no longer in AA. It says, "To Dad, this works. It really does. Love, Brent." You know, It was very meaningful for me to read that because I knew that at one point in time, my brother was a pretty special guy when he was doing this stuff. He stopped doing it, and you know what happens when we stop doing this stuff. But I picked that book up and I started reading it. A lot of it was Greek, like I just couldn't get with a lot of it. I couldn't understand a lot of it, but I kept forging forth because I knew that it was in there. And every once in a while, I'd read something and I'm like, oh God, it would just hit me. It was like, it just, these people knew what they were talking about. And I love that doctor's opinion. It says we are irritable, restless, and discontented till we can experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. So that tells me that stone cold sober with no alcohol in me, I am irritable, restless, and discontented. I came out of the womb like that. And that's the truth. And I had never heard that sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't hear it from anybody. I'm sure that it was being said. I just didn't hear it. I read it there for the first time, and it hit me. You know, it just hit me. And then I read further in the book because I wanted to know, well, if that's the problem, if that's my problem, sobriety is my problem, that alcohol is not the problem, sobriety is my problem, then what's the solution? Well, I'm glad that I asked that question because later on in the book, it says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main purpose is to get you to God, to a higher power, power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. So now I'm told that I've got a higher power that will solve my problem. And the main purpose of this book is to get me there. So now I don't have to keep going around wondering, like, where is God? Like, I can go through this book. And if I take these steps, then I'm going to have this spiritual awakening. It tells me right there in the 12th step, having a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. As the result of these steps. That's the result. That's what we're coming here for. Not sobriety. Not sobriety. If you think it's about sobriety, it's just not. Sobriety is going to be one of the requirements. I mean, it's going to be hard to get, you know, to have that if this is filled with vodka. You put, you know, I mean, it really is. But if you're sober and you do this, that's the end result. That's what we're here for, is this spiritual awakening. That is what's going to revolutionize and change my very life. That's how I'm going to recreate my life. You know, that's the only way that it was going to happen for me. So I threw myself into this, man, and I'm going through this book, and there was this guy I was, you know, I'd been praying about. I said, you know, I need someone who knows this stuff, maybe a little bit better than me, or someone who's into it, who's a buddy, because there really wasn't many people around in the area. And one day I'm walking through town, and there's this guy about this tall, and he shaves his head, and he's got just one little tuft of hair on top, and he's got it multicolored, and you know, he's a vegan and he smells funny and he wears sandals and all this weird stuff. And he's often balancing a book on his head. And I'm like, this dude is a freak. And then one day he walks into the room. I'm like, oh my God, this guy's going to get sober. I got to try to help this guy. And I go over to talk to him and he pulls his big book off of his head and he introduces himself. And I knew instantly it was at that moment that God had sent that man to me, to that meeting. He was going to be the one that I was going to be able to go through this book with, you know, and it blew me away. And he told me not too long after that, he was a genius. Tommy is an absolute genius. He was furious with God that he had to go to Princeton University. He was so mad. He wanted to get into Harvard so bad. That was his thing. And believe me, he qualifies for it. He is just so bright and he knows he qualifies for it. And one day when we were sitting there talking, he said, you know, Eric, I realized, you know, God didn't send me to Princeton because I had to go to Princeton. God sent me to Princeton so I could be a part of your life, be a part of the lives here. Has nothing to do with what school I go to. Nothing to do with it whatsoever. And his resentment was gone. That was a beautiful thing. Tommy became one of my closest friends, and he still is one of my dearest friends ever right now. But he started taking me through the book, and he would kill me, man. I would call him up and be like, Tommy, this is what's going on, da-da-da-da-da. And he'd say, how's your 11th step? I'm like, no, you don't understand, man. This is what's going on. He goes, did you pray this morning? Did you meditate? I'm like, Tommy, seriously? He's like, go pray, go meditate, give me a call back. All right, fine. Did you ask God for guidance and direction? Did you write down your inventory at the end of the night last night? No, I didn't do any of this because I wouldn't do those things. See, Bill Wilson talked about it. He talked about self-knowledge. You know, we get a lot of self-knowledge sitting in his rooms. We'll understand what alcoholism is about. We'll know what it is. We can memorize this book. And I know that I was one of those guys for a little while where I stopped doing this. But I know the book, but I'm not doing it. And I'll spout it off and I'll sound good. And people come up and say, hey, dude, would you be my sponsor and all this stuff? And I'm like, yeah. And then we're outside talking. And I'm telling them what they do and everything will be all right. And then I'm walking away saying, yeah, but when's it going to be all right for you, Eric? You know, when's it going to be all right for you? When are you actually going to start doing this stuff again? You know, so I would call Tommy up and he would say those things to me. And I would get bent out of shape, but it wasn't until I actually started doing those things that God was able to come into my life. We took this third step together, and I shared this not too long ago, flew out of my mouth. You remember that? And you might remember this. I'm sitting in a room with this guy. It's the first time I'm standing in a room with a guy, and I'm getting on my knees, you know, with a guy. And I'm like, what? this is a little, you know, awkward. And I don't know what happened. You know, I was inspired, and the words just flew out of my mouth from the podium. I said I was afraid he was going to pull a Brokeback Mountain on me. And I don't know where. But you know what? That was the truth. I mean, you know, I mean, look, I'm one of those guys. I came in here, and I was just so scared. There's got to be some other motive here. Like, he really just wants to pray. That's it? Like, really? We're down here to get – this is really odd. Truth is, all he wanted to do was pray, man. He just wanted to take me through the 12 steps. And, you know, it just had that moment. And thank God that I had the courage to just face that uncomfortability, that awkwardness, allow myself to be vulnerable and to go through with it and just be like, all right, God, if that's what it comes down to, I don't know what to say, but whatever, let's just go on. And that's what it came down to. I said this prayer and something started to happen, man. Something started to change. And Tommy looked at me and he said, look, this is going to have a great effect on you if you're lucky. And if it does, unfortunately, it's not going to last. The only thing that's going to help after this is that you're going to have to do this four-step inventory. We're going to have to get down to the causes and conditions of everything that's blocking you off from your higher power. And he was 100% right. Something did change. I did feel a lot better. And I started thinking differently. My life just started to change automatically on the outside. And that's the amazing thing, is that once you make connection with God, instantly your life begins to change, whether you realize it or not. Once you made that connection, the change has already begun, whether you realize it or not. It's like when you flip that switch, you know, sometimes you still have the light in your eyes. It takes a second for the room to get dark. But when that switch is off, man, that light is off. And when you turn it back on, I promise you the light is there. And it's changed your life, whether you realize it or not. And that's what happened. I said this prayer with Tommy. My life started to change. And we started to get into this inventory. And I was really excited about the inventory because I get to tee off on everybody that I hate, you know, and that resentment list. And I started off with my dad, you know, because he was just too tough on me. And my mom, she was too easy on me. And my brothers and da-da-da-da-da and you name it. And I list mile long and all the resentments, all the fear. And then I had to get to the part with the women because I had such a broken heart and how dare they, and, you know, all the stuff. And I'm writing it down and she left me and da-da-da-da-da. And then these guys were really smart, Bill and Bob. They knew exactly what they were doing when they came up with that turnaround column, that fourth column where it's time for me to look at myself. We're going to look at it from an entirely different perspective. And that was a killer, man. I'm like, oh, God. Because that's where it takes some courage. It's really easy to just spout off all this garbage, but it really takes courage. It takes courage. And I love that part. You know, I hear people say, well, you know, if you have fear, you have no faith, da-da-da-da-da, all this nonsense. I completely disagree with it. Right in the big book, it says all men of faith have courage. You don't need courage unless you've got some fear. Sorry. You just don't. You know, courage is only required when you're experiencing some fear, some anxiety. All men of faith have courage. I still had faith in God. I still had faith in God, but I was scared to look at that fourth column. But thank God I had the courage to actually write this stuff down, you know, and I took a good look at it, you know, and I was writing it down. And I got to tell you, third time, boom, spiritual experience started to happen as I was doing this, because I started to see where Eric showed up every single time in my life. It was unbelievable. It was right there in front of me in black and white. I couldn't avoid it, and I didn't want to avoid it anymore. And I gotta tell you, I speak to some people, I sponsor a bunch of people, when they come to me and they're like, I'm feeling really crappy, man. I just did the fourth column. I'm such a low person. I'm so horrible and all that. I don't understand that. When I did it, I felt so much hope because I was like, holy smokes, I don't have to behave like this anymore. Now I know what the problem is. It really gave me all this hope. This was the reason why every relationship failed. That's why she left me, not because I'm a loser, but because I'm a loser because I cheated on her. I wasn't just a born loser. I was a behavioral loser. You know what I mean? That was wild. That blew me away. And then when I coupled that with the third step, that I'm giving God all of these problems, I'm asking him to take away my difficulties and take away my problems, so that victory over them, so that you guys can witness, this means that God's going to be doing the work. I don't have to do it. And I realized in that fourth column that I couldn't do it. My best knowing drove me right into the ground. Just drove me right in the ground. And I don't have to do that. And I felt so much freedom. I couldn't wait to do that fifth step with him. When we sat down, he put on his glasses. I call him Professor Tom. Put on his glasses and he pulled out a red pen. I'm like, oh my God, here we go. Because he's like, let's get down to these causes and conditions. And he starts marking up my inventory. And I don't like this, man, because I was never much of an academic. And he's marking it up. I feel like I'm in school. And, you know, it was fun. We had a good joke about it. I was able to get past it, and we were able to get through it. And he asked me, when it came to my parents, he said, let me ask you a question, Eric. He said, do you have a roof over your head? I said, yep. He said, heat in the winter? I said, yes. Food in your stomach, doctors, education? I said, I had all of that. And he said, did you have air conditioning in summer, which is a luxury? And I said, yes, I had that luxury. Shoes on your feet, all of this stuff. And I said, yeah. He said, you had all of your needs met. All of your needs. You got everything you ever needed. The problem was when you didn't get everything you ever wanted, you felt like you got the short end of the stick. He said, you think that family revolves around you, that you were brought into this world for them to cater to you. And then he asked me the killer question. He said, what did you ever do to be a better son? Blew me away. I'd never thought about that. That never, ever, 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 ever occurred to me. Even to this day, sometimes it's hard for me to remember that. Sometimes I don't want to call my mom. She can be a bit of a nag, blah, blah, blah. I love my mom to death, but she's my mom, and that's part of what it is. And sometimes I had to pray and gear up for it, be like, okay, she's going to ask a lot of these questions that, like, why are you an actor? Because, mom, it's what I want to do. Yeah, but why? Yeah, but why? She's never going to get it, you know, and that's okay. And I just have this conversation with her. And sometimes I can get resentful about it, but sometimes I can just kind of change the conversation. We can move on to something else, you know, and that's okay. And that's how I participate. But back then, she'd say, why do you want to be an actor? And I'd say, F you, you suck. I'm out of here. I'm not taking any of this stuff. And basically what she's saying is that it's a really, really tough career, man. It's very competitive. You may not make a lot of money. You want to provide for a family. You sure that's the route you want to take? She's saying, I'm worried about you. You know, but I don't hear that. I hear, you're a loser, you're no good, and you make bad decisions, and a lot of that was true. But about hopes and dreams, you know what I'm saying? We all get that. So I was able to look at this and say, how can I be a better son to my parents? And then Tommy and I came up with a game plan how I could do that. First off was I did these defects of character, and I was going to have to be rid of them. Part of the problem was I like to steal from my parents, and then he told me why I like to steal from them, because I like free stuff. I like free stuff. And if you're not like holding on to it or paying attention to it, I kind of claim ownership and think it's mine, you know? So I had to stop doing that. And part of the thing that I had to do with these defects of character was I had to be willing to let go of wanting free stuff.